The following was recorded at 4 p.m. Eastern Time.
Not jumping to conclusions today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. The investigation into what brought down that Egypt air jet is just starting. The security expert says don't jump to conclusions, but
I also don't want to be blind to the reality that airplanes do not fall out of the sky for no reason.
Also, an Army chaplain who quit his job over U.S. drone policy and turned to activism.
I became a stockholder of Honeywell just so that I could confront the CEO, David Cote, on their profiting from armed drones.
Plus, that feeling you get when a broken jukebox comes back to life.
You feel like you want to dance. And when I hear the sound, I hear the music, okay, how I can make it better.
Those stories today on The World. Thank you for being with us. We start on a heavy note today, the loss of an airliner. There's still a lot we don't know about what happened to Egypt Air Flight 804. Here's what we do know. It was en route from Paris to Cairo early this morning. The Airbus 320 was cruising at 37,000 feet. Moments later, the plane went down. The World's Matthew Bell is here in the studio with me. Aside from what I just stated, Matthew, what else is worth pointing out about the crash so far?
So the flight, Marco, took off late last night from Paris. Just before 2:30 in the morning, the pilot spoke with air traffic controllers in Greece. Apparently, there were no problems. But then just a few minutes later, the airliner made a sudden 90-degree lurch to the left. Then it made a turn to the right, did a full 360 and dropped out of the sky. This is all from flight data information that people have tracked. This all happened above the Mediterranean Sea, about halfway between the island of Crete and the Egyptian coast. We don't know why this happened to the plane, but it increasingly looks like it did crash and it was catastrophic.
What are government authorities saying at this point?
French President François Hollande came out and said that no hypothesis would be left aside. He mentioned terrorism, said they'd be looking at that possibility. The aviation minister from Egypt went a bit further. He said that terrorism was probably a more likely cause than a mechanical issue for this crash. Egyptian officials have confirmed that some wreckage from the flight has been found in the water. But again, there's an awful lot that we don't know at this point. U.S. officials, for their part, have expressed condolences. They say that they're not ruling anything out at this point and that the United States is providing assistance with the search effort.
What about the passengers on board?
There were 66 people. That includes 10 crew members, about half of them Egyptians, 15 people from France, two Iraqis, and then one person each from a number of countries: Algeria, Belgium, Britain, Canada, Chad, Kuwait, Portugal, Saudi Arabia, Sudan. Marco, I saw some video online of people who had gone to the Cairo airport this morning. They were coming out of the building. They had talked to airline officials, apparently, and they were just shaking their heads, obviously distraught, and just said, we have no information, that they were being told really no details at all.
Some experts have been saying throughout the day that sabotage may be increasingly likely, citing lax controls at airports and loose hiring and security policies. And that just wouldn't be only at Charles de Gaulle Airport, would it? Not in this case.
Exactly. That's a hugely important question. But to make it even more complicated, you just look at this one plane had actually touched down on the ground in four different countries in just the previous 24 hours. It was in Eritrea. It had been in Tunisia, in Egypt, and in France. So you look at the reality of the international aviation system the way it is right now, and security is really only going to be as strong as the weakest link.
The World's Matthew Bell, thank you.
Thank you.
Juliet Kayyem is a former counterterrorism official with the Obama administration. She now teaches at Harvard and is the author of Security Mom. You tweeted earlier after one of today's earlier press conferences, Juliet, no point dithering on what is known already. Unforgivable press conference. Why'd you say that?
Well, at that stage, the Egyptian spokespeople were even unwilling to say that the plane was down. They were still calling it missing. Meanwhile, an hour before, you had the French president saying that the plane went down. And anyone knew by that stage, and you certainly just know from experience, that planes do not go missing for hours on end. At that stage, it was a couple hours without there being some kind of failure. We don't know what that failure is yet. And look, this is coming from the perspective of a history of concern concerns about Egypt and Egypt Air about their transparency in these airline accidents.
How have you seen the response to the tragedy kind of unfold throughout the day? Or you think there's been kind of an attempt to avoid jumping to conclusions as time has moved on?
Yes, there is. And I think that's right. But I also don't want to be blind to the reality that airplanes do not fall out of the sky for no reason. And there are a limited number of reasons at this stage. So one is catastrophic mechanical failure. The second is pilot error. And the third is something that we don't have to call it terrorism, but it is deliberative, right? Whether it's a passenger or a pilot or something put on the plane through luggage or, of course, at an airport facility. There was no SOS from the pilots, the erratic behavior, at least it seems like, of the plane, and other aspects that do not conclude that this was a deliberate attack, but certainly do not suggest that it is not.
You also tweeted earlier in response to the press conference earlier today, being defensive is not a good strategy. So, you know, not wanting to jump to the terrorism conclusion, right, but also wanting to be thorough. What's your best advice on what tone to strike?
So this is the hardest thing in any crisis, but it is full transparency at this stage. So this is not about Egypt. It is not about Egypt Air. It is not about the future of tourism in Egypt. It is about the people who lost their lives and their family members. And it is also about the future, the sort of safety and security of our global airline industry. Are there gaps in security? Where are those gaps? And how do we close them? Because what I know for sure is that the airplanes have to keep flying. You know, we live in a global environment and a global aviation environment in which you cannot stop airline travel while we wait to figure this out.
Juliet, I'm also curious, when you were at Homeland Security, what was the kind of routine and also speed with which, like one security detail of Nation A would pick up the phone to Nation B and start getting information?
Oh, it's minutes. Even last night when the plane went missing, what automatically happens is a determination of whether the citizenship of the passengers and, of course, a manifest review through terrorist watch lists. So that would have happened literally within 2 to 3 hours. The second issue, at least from the U.S. perspective, is going to be if there were any U.S. citizens. There aren't any, which means that the U.S. will be in a passive assistance phase, that it will offer help to Egypt and or France, but it won't have any, you know, legal or even political jurisdiction at this stage.
What clues are there to explore at this point for you?
The extent of the debris at this stage. Right. You know, does this look like an explosion or did the plane go down relatively intact? That physical evidence is going to be the differentiator, and we'll know that relatively quickly. And then, of course, the debris will give some clue as to whether there are explosives. And then the search for this black box that we are always searching for after all of these flights. People like me, people in the aviation industry now believe there has got to be a better way. But, you know, we're still looking for that black box.
Former counterterrorism official Juliet Kayyem. She now teaches at Harvard and is the author of Security Mom. Juliet, thanks as always.
Thank you.
You might remember our chat with reporter Jean Carstensen from earlier this week. She told us about the situation in an unofficial refugee camp in Idomeni in Greece. Some 10,000 refugees are in this camp going through months of limbo, and months of limbo can make tempers flare. And that's what happened last night, Idomeni making world headlines. Jean witnessed what happened. Jean Carstensen joins me again from Idomeni. Jean, tell us what exactly happened last night. What'd you see?
There was a clash between a very small number of refugees and the police, and it quickly escalated. Refugees rushed the border, and police responded with tear gas, and it just kept escalating and escalating. There were a lot of tear gas canisters going off. Most of the refugees in the camp were not participating. They were actually watching on in horror because they live in the tents in this camp, and the tear gas was going off all around where everybody was living. And it just got worse and worse, and finally tear gas engulfed the entire camp, and most people had to run with their families and their children to the edges of the camp. Even at the edges of the camp, people were still bending over and crying from the tear gas. It was a pretty unpleasant scene.
Any injuries from this?
There were a few injuries. Somebody went to the hospital, a young boy, last night. And this morning, there were some children coming to get help for their eyes and their respiratory systems. And also a couple of these canisters that had not fired last night, the kids were playing with them, and they went off in the camp today.
So, Jean, was this just tempers flaring after months of tension in this camp, or are there specific grievances refugees are upset about?
This is really a cauldron of unhappiness at this camp. People have been there 2 and 3 months. These are the people, Marco, that got stuck in Greece after the March 20 EU-Turkey deal went through. And these people all arrived and cried with happiness when they got to the Greek Isles. And then they found out that the politics were changing and that their chances of getting to Europe had gotten much, much more difficult. So these people made their way, a lot of them, to Edomeni, which is the last spot here in Greece. And they thought they'd be here for 1 or 2 days, and they've been here for up to 3 months, and they haven't yet been able to access the asylum system or apply for relocation to a European country. The whole deal went through so hastily that really Greece and the European Union has not gotten a system in place so that most people can apply. So they're really stuck in a terrible, terrible limbo. They're not in good conditions, and they don't know what their futures are going to be.
So you mentioned the tents in this informal camp, but it's set up in a train station, this camp, and refugees are also taking shelter in the trains. What's that like?
Yeah, there are about 10 sleeper cars on a side track, and they're obviously not going anywhere. And some families and people have moved in. And the other day, I spent some time with a Syrian refugee from Kobani. She came here with her husband and their adorable young baby. And I asked her, as I ask everybody, why did you leave Kobani? She's so miserable here. I really wanted to understand why she had made this journey, and she told me her story.
There's sometimes they were sleeping, everyone, and ISIS came and they cut heads of everyone while they are sleeping. Children, women, old people, young, everyone.
Yeah, so life is miserable in that refugee camp, but relatively better than what she left.
Yes, although I've heard some people say now that if they had it to do it again, they would go back. Now, she wouldn't, but others are so desperate, they don't know what to do. And somebody said today, actually, to a volunteer here, if she could get a plane ticket back to Iraq, she'd go back into the middle of the war just to get out of here.
Wow, that statement speaks volumes. After last night's tear gassing of this camp, what's next, Jean? Are people kind of settled back in?
Well, they're settling back in as much as they can, but people are very uneasy in the camp now, and it seems that policies are changing around how this camp is going to be run, at least for now. And a lot of people, I think, were really re-traumatized by what happened last night. When I was in the middle of the tear gas myself, I was running along with a Syrian friend, a family that I become friendly with, and he and I were commenting, you know, how awful it was to see all these kids that were crying because the tear gas was hurting their eyes. And you just don't want to see that when these are the same kids who have, you know, escaped war.
Jean Carstensen in Idomeni, Greece, reporting with support from the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting. Jean, thanks for speaking with us again, and keep up the great work.
Okay, thanks so much, Marco.
Jean's been traveling with photographer Jody Hilton. She's got some dramatic shots from last night's clashes in the camp. Just head over to PRI.org to check them out. A bit of good news from Nigeria. That's next. You're with the world. It's taken more than 2 years, but one of the more than 200 Nigerian schoolgirls kidnapped by Boko Haram has finally been found. You'll remember that the girls were kidnapped from their school in Chibok in northern Nigeria. A few of them escaped in the days after the kidnapping. For 2 years, though, there's almost no word of them, despite the global outcry to find them and bring them home. But yesterday came the news that one of the Chibok girls had appeared, carrying her 4-month-old baby. The girl's name is Amina Ali Nkeki, and she was flown to the Nigerian capital, Abuja, today to meet President Muhammadu Buhari. Chika Odua is a Nigerian-American journalist in Lagos who's been following the story.
The circumstances of her being found are still unclear. We're hearing two versions of a story. One version being put forth from the Chibok people. The claim is that she was actually found wandering in the forest Tuesday night and that vigilantes found her. But the Nigerian government has put out its own story, and that story came out Wednesday. And they're saying that Wednesday afternoon is when the Nigerian forces actually rescued rescued her. So they're actually framing it as a rescue mission. So whether this is her being found accidentally or rescue, it remains to be seen, but these are the two versions that we're hearing. But from my own research, it seemed as if she was found by vigilantes Tuesday, according to people I've spoken to from Chibok and her own family members.
Those are very different accounts of the story. Are Nigerians today, though, kind of discounting whatever version it is and just happy that she has been discovered?
Well, Nigerians are very much aware of the politicization of this issue. So they're definitely making comments on the fact that there are two strong narratives coming forth, and they're actually taking note of that as well. But they are definitely happy that this definitely seems to be one of the Chibok girls, because her picture, what we're seeing out now as far as the picture that was released by the military yesterday, definitely matches the picture that was given to the public by her mother 2 years ago. So it definitely seems this is the girl that we saw 2 years ago in photographs. So there is definitely some joy in that.
Did Amina talk at all to the press, and do we have any sense of what her captivity was like?
Well, she did actually talk to members of the Bring Back Our Girls activist. I know she has spoken to two news media organizations, but we do know that she does seem to be in a sound state of mind, which is a relief, at least from what we can see, because she was able to recognize her mother. She was able to recognize her vice principal in Chibok. And so these are actually good signs. But she did actually say that some of the rest of the Chibok girls are still in Sambisa Forest.
Yeah, I mean, how is the Nigerian government addressing the rest of the girls, those 276 girls who were kidnapped?
Well, they're hoping that she can give some intelligence, and I believe that she can, because what she's saying so far is that there are other girls still in that forest. Some have died. Hopefully we'll get more news, because many parents of the Chibok girls are dying of grief. Her own father died shortly after she was abducted.
Wow,
so it's just her mother who was still there. So hopefully we'll get some more intelligence about the whereabouts of the remaining 218 Chibok schoolgirls.
That was journalist Chika Odua in Lagos. Let's stay with the story for another few minutes. We've been checking in regularly with Nigerian writer Adobe Trishan Obani as the kidnapping saga has worn on. Adobe has been closely following the twists and turns of the Chibok girl story from the beginning, and she was there when Amina Ali Nkeki met with Nigeria's president in Abuja today.
It was a very emotional event when the president met with her and when we saw her, you know, when I saw her, I was in that event. But it was emotional in a joyful way. It wasn't sad at all. When she walked past me, I pressed her arm and she gave me a smile, but that was towards the ending. When she came in, she was completely covered up. So I thought she was going to remain shielded from the public throughout the event. It was being called a ceremony. But then when she was introduced to the president, and he stood up from his chair on the head of the table and walked up to her, they took off her veil. So it was the first time. It was almost like a formal presentation. And she smiled. She actually did smile. And the president beamed. He lifted the baby from her arms, carried the baby. Everyone was smiling. It was just so joyful, almost as if we were welcoming a new member of our family. And indeed, we were welcoming a member of our family. And I think today's ceremony was symbolic, because beyond the recovered girl, I think when the president lifted that baby from her arms and carried that baby, smiled at that baby, cuddled that baby, he was almost, it seemed to me as if he was saying, every child born in Nigeria is welcome, irrespective of whether your father is Boko Haram, whether your mother has been 2 years with the militants, it didn't matter. We were welcoming a member of our family, and that's the way it felt. The atmosphere was joyful throughout.
Were you able to speak with her?
No. I mean, I had planned to speak with her, but I understood that today wasn't a day for that. I think the president had made his speech and the focus was going to be on that and not on any distractions. So, but, you know, well, we took exchange greetings with her. She walked past us. When she walked past me, I grabbed her arm. I pressed it and she turned to me and she smiled. I held her baby. So that was as much interaction as people like me had with her.
Her four-month-old baby, what can you tell us about that child? First of all, male or female?
Oh, It's female. Her name is Sophia. She was screaming throughout, punctuating everybody's speech with her cries. And it was so sweet. Like I said, she wasn't wailing in pain. Like each time she would just this shrill cry and everyone would smile. So it added to the color, the joyfulness in the atmosphere. And like I said, a new baby is being welcomed, you don't complain that someone is crying. So the president will be speaking and we'll hear the baby cry. And I think at some point he made a joke about it. When she really yelled, they had to take her away because she was being carried by Miriam Mwais, who's a member of the Bring Back Our Girls group. So she, in fact, one of the founders, she had to take the girl out. And even when they had taken her out of the room, we could still hear her screaming and the people would smile every time she did that. So, I mean, the baby looked healthy enough. And from what the president said in his speech, for almost, total of 5 hours, medical personnel in different fields, NGOs, and even trauma specialists from UNICEF had been examined or had spent time with the girl, with Amina and her baby. So it looks like they're fine.
Adobe, as we've spoken since the kidnappings a couple of years ago, you've been critical of the effort to get the girls back. But you sound today really encouraged, even though Amina is just one of these many girls.
Yes, it was such a joyful occasion. I think I'm still bubbling with the joy of the event. But there's also the fact that thousands of girls have been rescued in the past few months, in the past many months.
Not from the Chibok, a lot of girls.
Not from Chibok. Yes, 1,000 girls from different communities. So that shows us, that's the evidence, that the government is doing something. They may not have found the Chibok girls yet, but they're doing something. And then now we recover one Chibok girl. I mean, this is, I think people like me have the right to bask in the joy of this moment. If I wake up tomorrow morning and get worried about and get upset that the government hasn't found the 219, fine. I mean, I want them to be found even now, but I also want to enjoy the joy of having one of them back with us. It's such a joyful thing and worth celebrating.
Adobe Tricia Nobani, always great to speak with you. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Marco.
You're tuned to The World. I'm Marco Werman. Suhaib Webb is an American imam. He regularly preaches against ISIS. In fact, Webb's words have landed him on the militant group's hit list. But ISIS is not his only enemy.
The threats against my life by the far right have been greater in frequency than they have been from radical Muslims.
The rest of Suhaib Webb's story coming up on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. For the next few minutes, we're going to step back from breaking news to talk about moral issues raised by war and meet two religious leaders with strong feelings about that. First, let me tell you about a chaplain who just resigned from the U.S. Army in a very public way. He wrote a letter to President Obama.
I resigned because I refused to support U.S. armed drone policy. The executive branch continues to claim the right to kill anyone, anywhere on earth, at any time for secret reasons, based on secret evidence in a secret process undertaken by unidentified officials.
Reverend Chris Antal, welcome to the program. Now, the other line from that letter we did not feature was, I resign because I refuse to serve as an empire chaplain. So first question to you. You know what the military does. Why did you join in the first place?
Well, Marco, I grew up in the wake of our war in Vietnam, and my father had served in that war as a medical officer. And I learned at a young age that war hurts, and I also learned to be skeptical of military solutions. And I thought growing up that I would never serve. That changed for me at September 11th, and I wanted to do my part. I wanted to carry my fair share, and I thought I could do that well as a chaplain.
Are you a pacifist now and were not when you signed up?
I used to think I was a pacifist when I was growing up. I now have a more nuanced view, and I do believe that there is a time to kill. And if you were to ask me when that time is, well, that's a really tough question to answer. But I do believe that there is moral justification for killing when It is protecting the innocent from certain harm.
Well, let's dig in a bit into your own story and find out how you kind of arrived at this nuanced position. I know you served in the New York National Guard at the same time you were a Unitarian minister. And in 2012, you were called up, sent to Afghanistan, and you saw drones taking off and landing. Pick up the story from there, if you would.
Sure. Well, I witnessed my first drone standing on the airfield in Kandahar, Afghanistan, where I was doing my duty as a chaplain to honor the dead at a dignified transfer ceremony. We would gather on the flight line whenever a service member was killed as the casket was transferred onto a C-17. There's taps, there's prayer. We salute as the casket is carried up the ramp. It was while I was standing on the flight line in those ceremonies that I saw the drones, surveillance, and also armed drones on the flight line.
And what did you think? I mean, just seeing those drones, what crossed your mind?
Well, being there for that dignified transfer ceremony is a very emotional place, and my heart was opened to the pain of the loss of these American lives. But to hold that with the drones and to stand there wondering who we were killing and who their families were and how they were grieving, it just created a break in my soul that I've tried to address by educating myself and eventually speaking up for where I've come to stand.
Why did you write to President Obama? Why go all the way to the Commander-in-Chief?
Well, I'm pretty outraged with the lack of progress. And before I took this this step, I personally advocated through my elected officials. I also engaged the members of my congregation in Rock Tavern, New York, in legislative advocacy and even shareholder advocacy. I became a stockholder of Honeywell just so that I could confront the CEO, David Cote, on their profiting from armed drones.
Your protest on drones, though, it comes at a time when there's a lot of hand-wringing in this country about sending troops into the Middle East, sending troops anywhere around the world. And part of the reason Washington uses drones is to avoid U.S. military casualties. How do you reconcile that?
Well, that's the real attraction of drones. It's been called by others the moral hazard of drones. It allows us to kill at no cost to ourselves. However, it is a breach of core military values, values like courage and honor. So while we may be protecting or lowering the risk of shedding American blood, we're doing so at a great moral cost. In fact, I think we are selling out our soul.
That was U.S. Army Chaplain Chris Antal explaining why he's quitting the Army over the Obama administration's use of drone warfare. Religious conviction also drives our next story. It's about Suhaib Webb. He's a blonde, blue-eyed former hip-hop DJ from Oklahoma City. Webb's grandfather was a fundamentalist Christian preacher. In high school, Webb was in a street gang. Then at age 20, he converted to Islam. Today, he's an imam and considered one of the most influential American Muslim voices, speaking out against extremism. So outspoken, in fact, that a few weeks ago, he landed on an ISIS hit list along with two other American imams. I asked Suhaib Webb why he thought ISIS had made him an obligatory target.
They mentioned in their description of me someone who tames our message, right? That's really kind of the pearl that's hidden in all of
that
statements.
That you tame the message?
That I tame people who may be interested in following them. Mm. And I think that's really the bigger picture. The accusation is this person is having an impact on people who may be on the fence when it comes to following us.
Do you feel like you're having an impact?
Being effective, yes, in a small part of our community. The masses of Muslims that I've dealt with, and I've been in Japan, Malaysia, Norway, Ireland, England, here over the last 2.5 months, are committed to really refuting ISIS. So am I being impactful at a large level? No, because the majority of Muslims that I work with and see are not impacted by ISIS in the sense of adherence to ISIS's cause. Since 9/11, the number of people that I've had to counsel out of being influenced by the kind of pseudo-jihadist ideology are less than 10.
Back to obligatory target, though. I mean, don't you read that as a death threat?
Oh, that's a death threat. I mean, I don't think we should dismiss that. That's a death threat for sure.
So how have you coped with that reality?
You know, I've been attacked by Fox News. So, you know, I talked with some security officials. I've talked with people that have received death threats from them in the past, and they seem to be very real threats. And certain changes are made in your life, but nothing too drastic. The threats against my life by the far right have been greater in frequency than they have been from radical Muslims.
You do get heat from both sides, from extremists and from Islamophobes. And the far right here in the U.S. has accused you of teaching hatred and calling for Muslims to engage in jihad, which are allegations you deny. What do you think is at the root of all the suspicion on both sides?
Well, I think that they both have incredible synergy. I think that ISIS's biggest problem with someone like me is that I'm able to show I can live in America as a Muslim, but I can also live in America as an imam. I think the same thing applies to the far right in this country. First of all, they are absolutely anemic when it comes to the knowledge of Islam. But again, their thought process is very similar to ISIS, that Islam and the West are incompatible. So they actually agree on this issue. They see Islam in the same way.
What do you think is the way forward, you know, fighting ISIS and countering that energy with an energy here in the U.S. that involves all faiths coexisting at the same time? It sounds like it would be really tough.
Well, I mean, I think as the West moves forward, we have to talk about faith and the faithless living together, right?
Non-believers.
Yeah, of course. I mean, I think that we're either going to sit around and fight all day long about God exists or doesn't exist, or we are going to strap up our boots and do great work to heal really a fractured world. I think the way forward for the Muslim community is, number one, the Muslim community is doing really great work. You look at Iman in Chicago, Inner City Muslim Action Network, which runs one of the largest low-income health clinics in Chicago. The same thing can be said of Umma Clinic, a free clinic run in South Central Los Angeles. I mean, there's great work happening. I think it gets distorted or blotted out because it only takes one jihadi to kill a lot of people, unfortunately, to do a great act of terror. So I think the Muslim community institutionally is very healthy. Mosques are doing great work across the country. But if you look at America and the West today, one of the number one pop singers is Zayn Malik. One of the most popular models is Gigi Hadid.
Right.
Muslims are everywhere, right? Dave Chappelle. Muslims are everywhere. They're across the board and have been, right? Muhammad Ali is the greatest boxing champion. So I think we need to continue to foster not necessarily those being spiritual role models. I'm not here to judge their faith. But I think we need to remind people that we have been and are very much part of every aspect of Western culture. And in the most, perhaps, those aspects of culture which are farthest from the mosque, right? You see Muslims doing very well. We have to highlight the fact that we are not a monolith religiously. We are not a monolith culturally. That really is what undermines ISIS, right? Participation, the ability to be involved in different aspects of society undermines the claim that Islam and the West are incompatible.
That was Imam Suhaib Webb, founder of Center DC, a faith-based community center. He's one of three American imams currently on an ISIS hit list. Our next story sounds like the plot of some kind of art film, but I promise you it's real. It's about a young Moroccan woman who rides Greyhound buses across America. She does it to meet people, to share a bit about her culture and break down stereotypes. Sometimes she even takes the conversations into people's homes and gets a free place to stay for a night. Now she started a business helping others find cross-cultural homestays. Here's the world's Jason Margolis.
The first thing you notice about 22-year-old Yasmin El-Bagari is her hat. When we met, she was wearing a sequin fedora from New Orleans.
I have 32 hats. I found hats a great way to connect with people because everyone comments on your hat. You know, it's a story and it sparks a conversation.
She first came to the U.S. as a high school exchange student in Kansas. She later ended up in Amherst, Massachusetts at Hampshire College. But she doesn't call Western Mass home, or rather her only home.
Home is, the world is my home. Every city I go, I have a place to live. I have my stuff all over in California, in D.C., in New York, in Amherst. People, families actually, who opened their homes to me for free.
Where's your clothes, though, and your stuff?
I literally have stations in different places. So my cold clothes are in Massachusetts and a host in California, in Encinitas.
For her senior thesis, El Bagari turned her lifestyle into a website called Voyage. The tagline is Travel for a More Peaceful World. It's kind of like Airbnb, but no money is exchanged, just conversation.
The goal is for people to connect one-on-one and to go from the online back to the offline. You know, like you used to be in the 70s without internet, where people can meaningfully and authentically connect and share experiences and stories.
The website is still in its pilot stage, but here's how it works. You sign up, if you're approved, then living rooms across the world are your oyster for brief stays. Or if you want to be a host, your living room is now open to others. Voyage is currently funded by grant money and also gets help from Hampshire College and Google. El Bagari hopes to open Voyage to the wider public by the end of the year. To date, almost 250 people have used Voyage, hosts and travelers.
I actually brought 30 kids from Africa last summer on a voyage to California. And they stayed with American host. They got to learn about each other's cultures and learn about personal development with Tony Robbins.
Tony Robbins, as in the motivational speaker on late night TV.
Yes.
How did that happen?
I know, right?
But here's a few lingering questions I had speaking with El Bagari. Has she ever had any problems as a young Arab woman traveling on her own? She insists she hasn't. Also, can Voyage accomplish its goal? Are a few homestays going to change attitudes and create a more peaceful world? I'm not the first one to say, come on, really?
Of course. I get so many negative reactions. But once they meet me, at least in person, they sometimes often change their mind, especially after I share my story and how I've been hosted in 150 homes from all walks of life. Mm-hmm.
So I did some homestays when I was in my 20s in Asia. And it was really amazing in many ways, but it was also kind of tiring, like to always be a guest in someone's house. Do you ever get tired just having to be friendly and on, if you will?
No, actually. I'm so inspired by people. So I always want to dig in more and more to really figure out like what they're all about and what drives them and what makes them who they are. I think people give me a lot of energy, and I wouldn't be doing Voyage if that wasn't the case.
But she adds that introverts can also use Voyage. The website asks your desired level of engagement. So if you want, you can chat with your host for a few minutes, then retire to bed. El Bagari says if even that sounds exhausting, there's always a hotel. For The World, I'm Jason Margolis.
I'm Marco Werman, and it's The World. One British pound, that's about $1.50 today, and that's what it'll cost you to leave the rat race behind. How does prime farmland in Wales sound? Unparalleled views of the Irish Sea. This is the scene on 140 acres called Park Farm. The offer comes from a British charity that's looking for a caretaker. There's got to be a catch, right? So we called up William Greenwood. He's with Britain's National Trust.
For £1 a year, they're going to get a four-bedroom bungalow overlooking the Irish Sea, one of the most wonderful views that you could possibly get anywhere every time they open their doors. And they're going to get 416 sheep.
So you get out of the rat race, but the catch is you enter the sheep race. Not that bad, really, but the lucky farmer will be managing a pretty big flock.
416 sheep come with the farm. Yes, they do, yes. The catch really is that instead of asking them to farm by putting the sheep inside the farm walls and on the fields that are bright green and nice sweet grass, but to put the sheep outside onto the headland where there's a lot of gorse, there's a lot of bracken, there's a lot of heather, but that's where all the conservation value is, outside the walls of the farm.
Greenwood says the sheep are a key part of a conservation plan, sustainable grazing. It protects some rare species.
A couple of butterflies, silver-studded blue and grayling. There's the wild Cotoni aster that exists there and nowhere else in the world. So it's really unique that we've got razorbills, we've got guillemots, we've got the chough, which are really rare birds. But their habitat, this grassland outside the walls, it's becoming choked up with rank grasses because it's not been grazed enough.
So if this sounds like the gig for you, get out your herding stick and find a border collie. And don't throw away that vintage pair of shearing scissors quite yet.
Oh, yeah, that's what the farmer will be doing. He'll be looking after those sheep on a day-to-day basis. He'll be shearing them, he'll be lambing them. And he'll be rearing those sheep, because what he wants is a really, really productive flock of sheep, because that's where he's going to get his income, or she's going to get her income, because it's open to everybody, this job.
The job was posted just yesterday. Greenwood says they already have 700 applications.
It's going to be quite a long day sifting through them all, I suspect, or long days sifting through them, trying to find that unique person for this unique site.
Yeah, and if it's a unique opportunity, why, Mr. Greenwood, did you not take the job?
I already live and work up here. But if I was a bit younger, I'd be interested in, because it's such a perfect place to live. I don't think you could have anything better.
I think you'll agree. Check out what Park Farm looks like up there in northern Wales. Videos at PRI.org. Oh, and applications are due by noon on June the 10th. Our final story today is about an unlikely hero. He's a Los Angeles resident who's devoted his life to repairing and protecting one of my favorite machines, the jukebox. KCRW's Saul Gonzalez takes it from there.
There's a block of Pico Boulevard in Los Angeles that's pretty typical 2016 LA, with lots of small mom-and-pop shops run by immigrants from Latin America and Asia. But walk into one business and you'll see machines that are relics of 20th century American life, blasting music from a different era.
Get out in that kitchen and rattle those pots and pans.
This is Magdi Hanna's workshop. He's from Egypt and is one of a handful of people left in the U.S. dedicated to fixing jukeboxes. His mission? To save the machines for future generations.
That's American history, jukebox. It's like, you know, in Egypt, somebody tried to break the pyramid.
Hanna has been repairing jukeboxes since 1980. Some of them are 50, 60, and 70 years old. Born in the Egyptian port city of Alexandria, he says he didn't know anything about the machines until he came to the U.S.
I never see a jukebox.
You never saw a jukebox until you came to the United States?
Exactly. I don't know what is this.
You didn't see jukeboxes in Egypt as a child?
No, we don't have jukebox in Egypt.
Hanna fell in love with jukeboxes and pretty quickly decided to devote himself full-time to repairing them. Now, in the 20th century, jukeboxes could be found in nightclubs, bars, and diners. They were icons of American life, right up there with Marilyn Monroe, the Corvette, and this guy.
You ain't nothing but a hound dog.
But a machine that played a limited selection of records couldn't compete with technological progress, from the transistor radio to CDs to now, of course, music over the internet. So jukebox companies like Wurlitzer and Seeberg faded away, along with many jukebox repair experts.
I know few, but I don't know new people coming to the jukebox business. It's no people new coming.
Not surprisingly, Hanna has little affection for new ways to hear music.
Like you hear Elvis Presley in 45, it's completely different than you hear it in the radio or in the CD.
On a CD or on a computer.
Or on the computer.
It's more human to you.
Yeah, it's feeling. Like the song Feeling.
Feeling.
The day I visited Hanna, he just finished repairing a Model 850 Wurlitzer jukebox from 1941. He showed it to me, opening the handsome wood exterior with peacock figures etched into glass.
Oh, look how big the motor is, like alternator for car now.
Yeah.
And here is the grinder that's for the coin. One song for 5 cents.
One song for five cents.
2 songs for 1 dime. 4 songs for quarter.
Hanna's customers are often collectors, bringing in broken jukeboxes they found at garage and estate sales. Each one is like a musical time capsule, with the records in them untouched for decades.
You know, some people have the jukebox in the garage for 20 years, and it has a record from the 50 and 60 original record.
It must be very satisfying when you take a machine that hasn't been played for years, you repair it, and you're the first person in decades, maybe, to hear sound coming and hear music coming out of that jukebox.
You feel like you want to dance. And when I hear the sound, I hear the music, okay, how I can make it better.
As I wrap up my visit to his repair shop, I ask Hanna if I can select a song from one of the jukeboxes he's repaired. He agrees, and not having used a jukebox since sometime in the 1980s, I gotta say, it was a little thrilling.
Let me try My Special Guy, the 16s, number 19. Hold on.
There, coming on the night.
There it goes. Listening to that music coming out of a 60-year-old machine, all of a sudden, iTunes and Spotify didn't seem nearly as cool. For the world, I'm Saul Gonzalez, Los Angeles.
Love the harmonies. Saul got some great shots of Magdi, his workshop, and his jukeboxes. They're up at PRI.org. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We're back tomorrow. I know you're sorry, and I'm sorry too. But I can't help it, I love only you.
PRI, Public Radio International.